Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast. This week on Story, we'll join Breaking Bad creator and showrunner Vince Gilligan for a retrospective look at the 1971 cult classic, The French Connection. Based on a true story, William Friedkin's 1971 hit, The French Connection, gave audiences its first taste at what a truly realistic cop film could be. Starring Gene Hackman as Detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle, the film follows the story of a driven New York cop whose intuitive street sense allows him to sniff out the secret players in a colossal heroin import operation, bringing the drugs into New York from Marseille. At a time when drug addiction was at an all-time high, The French Connection brought a sense of realism to Hollywood's law enforcement films by throwing the proverbial book at them. Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan, an avid fan of Friedkin's work, sat down with me after a retrospective screening at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of The French Connection, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. This was a part of our retrospective series that we're doing with the Academy of Motion Pictures, and wanted to have a lot of the people that are coming in this year show something that a film that actually impacted them or meant a lot to them. Why French Connection for you?
Well, I think, I don't know, it just kind of works for me. I mean, the ending is kind of a bummer that, you know, that Popeye Doyle works that hard to get Alain Charnier. I'm terrible with my French pronunciation, otherwise known as Frog One in the movie. Yeah. He works very hard to get this guy, and the guy gets away. And this is based on a true story, based on a book by Robin Moore. And the boss, forget the character's name, but the boss who Popeye and Cloudy are always going to and saying, you got to give us a wire. You got to give us two wires. Come on, let us do this thing.
This little candy store guy, he's put on a big show in a fancy nightclub. With
no narcotics connections. They were all over him.
And then on our own, after working the whole day and night, we tail him to Brooklyn. And we sat on him for practically a week. Now, who do we come up with? Joe Weinstock, for Christ's sake. Now, you got to let us have it.
Do you believe all this crap?
I go with my partner.
What'll it take?
A wire.
No, two wires.
Two wires.
One on the store, one on the house.
You know I have to get a court order for a wiretap, don't you?
But you'll try.
We know you can do it, Walt.
That's the real Popeye Doyle. That's Eddie Egan, who the character is... Popeye Doyle is based on, and Sonny Grosso's in there somewhere as well, who is the character that Cloudy, the Roy Scheider character, is based on. And Muldrig, the FBI agent who gets killed at the end by Popeye, is actually Bill Hickman, the amazing stunt driver who did, when it wasn't actually Gene Hackman driving underneath the L tracks, it was Bill Hickman doing the driving. And it was interesting using these, Friedkin using these non-actors in these important roles, and it adds this sort of verite feel to me. It makes it just feel real somehow, and that extended to a guy that Friedkin wanted to cast for Popeye. He didn't originally want Gene Hackman. He was dead set against him, and he wanted Paul Newman. And Paul Newman was out of their price range for this movie because I think this is a fairly low-budget movie. And then he wanted Jackie Gleason to play Popeye Doyle, who is wonderful, the great one, you know, Jackie Gleason. But Jackie Gleason apparently was box office death at the time because he had just made the movie Zhigo, which had been a big flop. And then he wanted, who else? He wanted Peter Boyle, who read the script and said, no, it's too violent. I don't want to make movies like that, apparently. Or rather, maybe Popeye is too much of a, he's kind of an asshole. He's kind of a reactionary, you know, he might have been. And maybe he was probably coming off of Joe at that time, and he already played that kind of a character. I'm just guessing. And then back to the verite thing, apparently his next choice, Friedkin's next choice for Popeye Doyle, was Jimmy Breslin, the newspaper columnist who had never acted before in his life. And Friedkin really wanted him. And apparently Jimmy Breslin said, I'm not getting behind the wheel of a car. I'm a New Yorker and I don't drive, and I'm not getting behind the wheel of a car. So that's what some of my research told me. I don't know how accurate it is, but it sounds interesting. So
Popeye Doyle is not the greatest guy. I mean, Frog One, Frog Two, he's kind of a not very kind to foreigners, and he also just lets a baby
roll away while he continues to shoot. I mean, he's not exactly the guy you want standing behind you. So what's your, is this then an interesting
character? I agree with everything you said except for the baby. Oddly enough, he's a racist, and he's a rough cop, and he doesn't mind beating up on suspects, whether they're innocent. You know, he's guilty and assumed guilty until proven innocent. And he's that kind of a guy, at least in the movie. But yeah, when the sniper is shooting at him, that's probably the thing to do at that point is to, especially when he himself is the target of the shooting, which I think he quickly ascertains. So, you know, if he ran toward the baby, I'm guessing at that point, if he ran toward the baby carriage, he'd probably just get the baby shot for sure at that point. The thing that's always hard for me to buy when I watch the movie is the fact they get that that Lincoln back together so quick. Yeah, that was quick, huh? I think I heard somebody in the audience are like, oh, I can't wait to see the French TV guy's face when he sees his car all in shambles. And then all of a sudden it's magically put back together. That was a little hard to buy.
I think that Friedkin did something really interesting here with when you look at today's action films, and I think this was an action film when it came out, and you compare it to something now, say Bad Boys, it's not things blow up every 15 minutes and there's car chases that go on for 20 minutes. And here, there's a lot of space and quiet and then eerie. Like the soundtrack for this was atmospheric, you know?
Don Ellis, who was the composer for this, was really brilliant. He passed away very young, only in his mid to late 40s, I think, probably only in the late 70s. He didn't live that much longer than this movie. And just a fantastic soundtrack, just eerie. And I love that, I guess it's a bass fiddle that sort of... That I can't really do it, but that throughout that undertone, I love that, and then the piano that's the counterpoint to it. It's a great score. It's very hard to find on the internet or find on CD. I finally tracked down a CD, an old out of issue CD of it on eBay or something. I had to pay like $75 for it, but man, it was worth it. It's a great soundtrack. Yeah.
Well, it just adds so much, especially at the end, that tone that's in there when you're basically getting the point 35, 40 years ago that war on drugs maybe isn't working. These guys just get away with it. And that sound just makes it even more powerful, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Imagine that ending now. That was very much a, you know, kind of a bummer sort of a 70s or European film kind of ending where, you know, our entire lives are pointless. You know, everything we do comes to naught. You know, that ending, there's no way a Hollywood movie would end that way now. They even if it happened that way in real life. And I think they probably took some liberties with the story, but that kind of a bummer ending was very of the 70s and very sort of European feeling. And yeah, that they wouldn't do that now, for sure.
No, I can't even imagine this movie.
And there's action. And as you said, there's action. And that fantastic car chase where the car's chasing under the L tracks is just white knuckle. That holds up to, for me anyway. That's like gangbusters. But I think most of the movie is really a character study of these two characters. And there are a lot of moments of quiet, like you say, where it's just, you know, it's they put the straw hat in the back, which says that they're on the job, and they hang out all hours of the night into the wee hours of the morning, and that's the job. And it's interesting to see that portrayed in a film in a somewhat leisurely or extended fashion. You'd be hard pressed to see that in a Hollywood movie today. You'd have the test audience saying, "Man, I'm just sitting there forever," and these guys are like bored, and it's 4 a.m. You know, let's cut to the car explosions.
Yeah.
You know, my girlfriend Holly and I last couple times ago when we were in New York City, she was a real sport, and finding the location of that L station, we went out to Stillwell Avenue out in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. We retraced the scene of the big chase, and we ended up at the exact staircase. I think it's the 62nd Street or 62nd Avenue rather, out in Brooklyn. I forget exactly which one, but it's you can find all that stuff on Google, as we did. And you know, she and I posed for pictures at the exact spot where Popeye Doyle kills Frog 2, shoots him in the back. That was a lot of fun.
You shot Mulderick. Some is here. I saw it. I'm gonna get him.
Interpretation of that last gunshot where Popeye Doyle shoots off camera, but he and Frog One are still alive?
That's a very good question. That is a, you know, I'd love to ask William Friedkin that. That's a very good question. I think that's a little bit of, I would imagine that's a little bit of poetic license to end on a mysterious, you know, shot fired. Did he shoot yet another cop? Did he just shoot at a shadow? But clearly, I mean, you're thinking, oh, he got somebody or somebody got him. But then you see those somewhat deflating, that those legends at the end about what happened really happened to everybody. I interpret it as a little bit of just ending with a bang, literally. Not no pun intended, but I think that's what he was, I would guess that's what he was doing.
How much did this movie actually influence your writing style?
When I came out to introduce the movie, I talked about the visual idiom of the sort of newsreel type handheld camera. I realized watching it, there's probably a lot more inspiration I gleaned from this movie than even that. That sort of the cold opening, even right down to Popeye Doyle's hat. It's a little Heisenbergian, in hindsight. He's a slob and he's a drunk, you know, and he's not James Bond. He's not Sean Connery or anything, and yet he looks kind of cool in that big woolen overcoat and the gloves and the pork pie hat. That guy really made a pork pie hat cool. Gene Hackman did. And a couple of days beard growth, you know, a decade and a half before Don Johnson made that cool with Miami Vice. And there's something about, you know, a guy who's good at his job. He may not be a good guy, but he's good at his job and he cares and he's driven and he has passion. And there's something that pulls you along as a viewer with that. And maybe, you know, in that sense, he has inspired me in the creation of Walter White or Heisenberg. You go back to some of these 70s movies and before, honestly, before the 70s, but using this as an example of the beginning of a decade of movie making, there's not that much music in this movie, and some pretty tense moments are dry, but when Don Ellis's score does kick in, I want more of it. I'm greedy for it, and I want more of it. And so that, I'd like to say that this inspired that choice in Breaking Bad, but honestly, it was a note from an AMC executive who said, when I delivered the Breaking Bad pilot, the first cut of it, I put in a bunch of temp score that I'd, temp music I'd pulled off my iPad. And her note that really made Breaking Bad better was she said, "Do you not believe in your own pilot?" And I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" She says, "There's wall-to-wall music. Are you telling me how to feel through these music choices?" And I was a little bent out of shape, but in hindsight, she was absolutely right. And I look to this movie and I see that, you know, less music very often works, because more music, conversely, makes you feel like I'm being manipulated by all this music, you know, unnecessarily sometimes.
Okay, who would win in a fight, Popeye Doyle or Heisenberg, Walter White?
Popeye, if it was mano a mano, like toe-to-toe, Popeye Doyle would wipe the floor with Walter White. But Walter White is a lot smarter and plays a longer, deeper game. So ultimately, I'd bet on Heisenberg, yeah.
When did you first see this movie? Do you remember?
You know, I don't even remember, but I can tell you I did not see it the first time on a big movie screen. I think I've only seen it twice in my life, today being one time on a big movie screen. I think I saw it once at the Aero Theater as well a couple of years ago. And Owen Roizman, the director of photography, was there for that screening, which was awesome. Fantastic. There's a scene when Popeye gets his informant in the men's room, puts the nickel in and gets into the pay toilet, and he's been beating the guy up, roughing him up, and then they seem like buddies once they're in the pay toilet. That I think that's the famous scene shot under a single incandescent, just a regular, you know, 60-watt or 100-watt light bulb. Owen Roizman used natural light as much as possible, or available light, if not natural light, available light as much as possible. And because these faster film stocks were just coming into production at that point. And it's a really interesting, gritty, grainy movie. A lot of the dark stuff you can see has really been pushed in the lab, and it looks grainier and a little milkier than usual. But it just, to me, it adds to the rough edges of this thing. And
that last scene where they're in the warehouse after it's been shot through is just so beautifully shot. It's
beautiful.
Yeah.
They probably pushed it a couple stops just to get that level of detail visible to the audience. Another good, I'm full of all kinds of, I've looked up all kinds of fun facts about this thing. Another fun fact about actors in this thing is Fernando Rey, who plays Charnier, who plays Frog One, is so good in this movie. And the story is, Friedkin asked his casting person to look into this actor who was in Belle du Jour, this Louis Buñuel movie. He said, there's a guy, he's this Spanish actor, but he's the guy I want for Charnier. So they fly this guy in from Spain, wherever he was in Europe, and he's the wrong guy. It was Fernando, you know, they thought Fernando Rey, because Fernando Rey was in quite a few Buñuel movies, but apparently the guy that Friedkin was thinking of was an actor named Francisco Rabal, if I'm pronouncing his name right. And Francisco could speak neither English nor French, so they figured, well, might as well go with Fernando Rey. And Fernando Rey, who is Spanish, apparently his French was not much better than mine, and they dubbed, when he's speaking French in the movie, that's apparently another actor's voice. So when he's speaking English, that's his actual voice, but the French is another story.
Movie magic. How much did Popeye Doyle influence the character of Hank on Breaking Bad?
If you watch Breaking Bad, you'll remember a couple times in one episode, Hank says to Walt, before he knows that Walt is Heisenberg, he says, I want to be the one to put the cuffs on him. I want to, just like Popeye Doyle to Frog One, I want to do this.
So you think this Gale person is your Heisenberg?
Yeah, I think so. God, I wanted to get this guy.
It looks like you did.
Nah, I mean, you know, me personally, you know. I wanted to be the one to slap the handcuffs on him, that kind of shit. Popeye Doyle waving to Frog One.
If I recall, at least from the first French Connection, Popeye Doyle never actually caught him.
Yeah, I guess mean old Popeye, huh? Day late and dollar short.
We had Dean Norris, who was not as familiar with the French Connection. We found that clip from the movie, and because I wanted him to move his fingers just like, you know, because in the movie, obviously, Charnier through the subway window goes like this, and then that's obviously Popeye Doyle mimicking that back to him in a screw you fashion, you know. So we had Dean Norris in the later episode. He actually does that. He does that to Walt, and that was absolutely straight from this movie. It's funny. He, in a sense, he inspired on some level, in my mind, he inspires Heisenberg, but he very much inspires Hank as well. And they're sort of two peas in a pod. They both are men of great will to succeed in their separate fields, Walt in criminality and Hank in law enforcement and catching his man, as it were.
Popeye Doyle is a pretty flawed character. How do you feel about the flawed protagonist?
That's yet another thing that was inspired by the French Connection in Breaking Bad, the idea of a less than sterling protagonist. I think it's very interesting. I mean, using this as an example, I think it's interesting when, and obviously I thought it was interesting enough to tell that kind of a story for 6 years of Breaking Bad, but in this, using this movie as an example, I think it's interesting when our protagonists are not sterling, when they do not wear the white hat. And you got to think, 1971, or probably the winter of 1970, I guess, when maybe it was 71 when they were shooting this. This was the first R-rated movie to win an Academy Award for Best Picture, because the rating system had gone into effect not that many years prior to this. And prior to the AMPAS rating system going in, pretty much every movie that came out of Hollywood was intended to be viewable by the whole family. And of course, they were coming out of a time, the 60s, the 50s before that, where The good guys, figuratively, sometimes literally, wore the white hat. The bad guys wore the black hat. And your good guys had to be drink milk and be pure and true and honest. And, you know, I'm exaggerating a bit, but there was a lot of freedom, obviously, coming into the 60s and early 70s, in which freedom to tell these kind of stories where the protagonist is not so good. He's kind of a, as we all saw, he's kind of a, you might want to have a beer with this guy, but you probably wouldn't want to hang around him that long. Also, because he'd keep you, you know, in a car till 4 a.m, you know. But I think it's interesting that, as we all know from our own real lives, people are, they wear gray hats a lot of the time. They're not, we're not all good, we're not all bad. And I think that was an interesting, when you put it in the perspective of the time it was made, it was a pretty, especially for an American movie, it was a pretty bold undertaking to have the guy you're rooting for be kind of a prick. You know, Dirty Harry came out same year, and which is a movie, another movie I absolutely love, and I love Clint Eastwood. But Dirty Harry is not quite the prick that Popeye Doyle is, which is interesting because Popeye Doyle's based on a real guy. Dirty Harry, as far as I know, is not. But Dirty Harry comes across as tough and mean, but, you know, there's a couple of winks to the audience that he's really not so bad. And he only ever kills bad guys. He doesn't kill fellow cops and stuff like that. So this was a pretty ballsy movie, which I applaud for being ballsy and original.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Underwriting is also provided by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software. Find out more information about Final Draft at finaldraft.com. On Story is also brought to you by the Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers based in Clarksburg, California. Makers of sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of their family values since 1968. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox, Olivia Crouch, and Colin Heyer. Editing help from Travis Neely and Travis Kennedy Sound. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.